Hello and welcome to a special edition video covering everything that you need to know about week one of the Trump trial. Let's dive right in, shall we? So the big picture of this trial is that it is the one revolving around the hush money payments paid to Stormy Daniels. But what does that actually mean? Let's jump into a little bit of the background really quickly in case you need a little refresh, okay? For legal reasons, everything I'm about to say is alleged, okay? 2016, right before the presidential election, remember that? Remember pre-2016 election? Those were good times. The National Enquirer tips off Trump that Stormy Daniels, a porn star, is selling rights to her story about an affair that she had with Trump in 2006. And it's alleged that Trump had a deal with the National Enquirer to catch and kill stories that could negatively impact Trump during the 2016 election, while publishing stories negative about his other primary challengers for the 2016 election. So National Enquirer would get negative stories on Trump, Trump would pay them to not publish them, or they would just tip off Trump that someone was going around trying to sell a negative story about him. And then Michael Cohen, who was then Trump's attorney and fixer, paid Stormy Daniels off to the tune of $130,000 to keep her silent, to keep her from publishing this story, which would have leaked right before the 2016 election and wouldn't look good because he's trying to run on this platform in the conservative party. Meanwhile, he's having affairs with porn actresses, apparently, which no shame, but for conservatives, shame, always shame. And Michael Cohen paid her off $130,000. He also allegedly paid off another woman, Karen McDougal, to not share her story of her interactions with Trump. And it said that Michael Cohen actually had to use a home equity line of credit to pay these women off, which, like, that's fucking sad. You're taking out a home equity loan for your boss? Couldn't be me. Then in 2017, Trump reimburses Cohen for these payments that he made, and it's divided up into 12 monthly installments and listed in the Trump Organization business records as legal fees, which is not what they were. Then in 2018, the Wall Street Journal breaks the story of these hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. Cohen's house is searched, and then he takes the fall, as Trump's cronies are wont to do, and pleads guilty to 8 federal charges of tax evasion, fraud, and campaign finance violations related to the payments to Daniels and to Karen McDougal. Cohen is then sentenced to 3 years in federal prison. At some point during that in 2019, he testifies before the House Oversight Committee about the payments, alleging that Trump knew about them and directed him to make those payments. Trump denied that at first. In 2021, Michael Cohen is released from prison, having served the last half of his sentence on house arrest because, you know, he's white and well-connected, classic. And then in early 2023, Michael Cohen meets with Manhattan prosecutors to assist them with this hush money case. He testifies in front of a grand jury. That grand jury then indicts Trump. He's indicted in March 2023 and pleads not guilty in April. Through much legal acrobatics, which is Trump's favorite, he drags his feet as long as possible until 1 year later, after he pleads not guilty, the trial is now officially underway. It started this past Monday. All right, let's break down the charges. Alvin Bragg is the Manhattan District Attorney. So he's the lead attorney in the Manhattan District. This is a state case, not a federal case. It is a criminal case, not a civil case. Alvin Bragg is heading this case, and it has 34 counts, criminal counts, against Trump for falsifying business records. Now, falsifying business records, it's a crime that's committed a lot, and it is prosecuted all the time. However, usually in the state of New York, it is a misdemeanor, which is a lower level than a felony. However, these counts against Trump have been raised to felony counts because Alvin Bragg and the prosecutors are claiming that this is part of a scheme to cover up an underlying crime. That underlying crime being breaking election interference laws by using money to influence the outcome of election and hide information that voters would have used to make their decision. So we've got the fraud, the falsifying business records as a means to obscure an underlying crime, that crime being election interference. But the actual counts are for falsifying business records. but they are felony counts. So here's what needs to be proved. First, that the business records were falsified, which there seems to be a lot of solid hard evidence showing that these records were falsified on purpose, but also Trump's knowledge and intent. Now, this is harder to prove. It needs to be proven that he intended to defraud someone with the falsified records, to defraud the American people or whomever, and that he intended for the falsification to cover up the underlying crime of election interference, meaning that did he know that he was interfering with an election illegally, and did he falsify the business records with the intent to cover that up? So the prosecutor has to lay out things that Trump did and what he said about it to get to that knowledge and intent. And they has to ask the jury to draw inferences from that. Why would Trump have done those things and said those things if he didn't have this intent? Luckily, Trump loves to run his mouth. So there's a lot of evidence of things he has said just floating out there on the internet straight from the horse's mouth or little fat fingies. This is where the underlying catch and kill scheme with the National Enquirer comes in. This is why it's so important, because it shows a larger scheme and a larger understanding that negative stories like the Stormy Daniels one could negatively impact the election. It shows he understood what these negative stories could do. He understood it so much that he had a whole scheme with the National Enquirer for catching and killing these stories so as to protect his chances in this presidential election. Therefore, he had the knowledge and the intent. And this is going to be proven through documentary evidence as well as witnesses of varying degrees of credibility. The star witness for the prosecution, of course, being Michael Cohen, who is set to testify despite having been convicted of perjury in the past, which isn't great. So they're going to need a lot of corroborating evidence to say, here's what Michael Cohen testifies. Here's hard evidence to prove that what he's saying is true. And that will hopefully help make up for his lack of credibility. But just because a witness has baggage like this doesn't mean that they're bad witnesses necessarily. Okay. So looking ahead at the trial schedule, originally they were assuming that they would take about 2 weeks for jury selection, but it turned out to only take one. And we'll get into the day-to-day what happened this week. And then they're expecting 6 to 8 weeks for the trial itself. So this trial is going to probably extend into June. Potential witnesses that could testify: Michael Cohen, of course, Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal, the other woman who was paid off, David Pecker, the former CEO of the National Enquirer's parent company, and a number of aides and members of the Trump organization, including Trump's assistant, Ronna Graff, former director of Oval Office Operations, Madeleine Westerhout, and longtime trusted aide, Hope Hicks. And also Trump himself may testify. Most people are saying he would be an awful witness for himself, but he does have the right to testify. Criminal defendants have the right to testify. They get to choose. Their lawyers can strongly suggest that they do not, but it's ultimately his choice. And it's unclear what would be on the table if he does choose to testify. Alvin Bragg has said that he would attack Trump's credibility by bringing in all these other legal judgments and cases against Trump that are happening outside of this trial. So let's talk about the potential outcomes of this trial. There are three. He could be acquitted, so the jury finds that he is not guilty. He could be found guilty, or it could end in a hung jury or a mistrial of some kind. If he's acquitted and the jury finds that there is doubt, because reminder, this is a criminal trial, and so the standard in criminal trials is that they need to find beyond a reasonable doubt that he is guilty. So if the jury finds that there is a doubt and acquits him, this would probably be a huge victory for Trump. It would bolster his supporters and even those undecideds who are on the fence. It might play into his whole theory that this is just a political trial based on charges that aren't real. Even though that's not necessarily what it means to be acquitted, it just means that there wasn't enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that these things occurred, but that doesn't mean that they didn't. It's just that there is still a little doubt. But for him, he'll be able to really play it up as, see, this was all political. This was a fake trial. And he might even, you know, try to bring charges of, like, you know, mishandling the prosecution or whatever. Who knows where it could go, but it would be a big feather in his cap to be acquitted in this trial. He could be found guilty. This is a Class E felony, which does come with the potential of 1 to 4 years in prison per count. Reminder, there's 34 counts, plus fines, maybe probation. However, he doesn't have any prior felony convictions. And for someone with no prior felony convictions for a financial, nonviolent crime, the likelihood of jail time is very low for Trump. If he did serve jail time, they would be concurrent sentences, so it wouldn't be 34 one-year sentences that go back to back, so he's in there for 34 years. They would be concurrently served, so all 34 one-year sentences would happen over the course of 1 year. But again, the likelihood of him going to jail is very, very limited, given he has no priors. However, many undecided voters have said that if he is convicted, that would convince them that he isn't fit to be president and would push them away from voting for him, which I'm like, if that's what it takes, if that's your final straw, that's wild. Like, everything else has been fine up until this. This is okay. Okay. But for his ardent supporters, it would just confirm that this is a witch hunt. This is a political trial. Like, not any outcome is going to just reaffirm the beliefs that his main supporters already have. But this, if he were convicted, if he were found guilty, this would give them even more fodder to believe that this government is corrupt and going after not only him, but them, because he's like their proxy, and that the government has to be taken down. So I'm a little spooked at the potential outcome if he is found guilty, as much as I, you know, there would be some schadenfreude to see him become a convicted felon. I don't really know if that would be a great outcome either, for a number of reasons. And then the third potential outcome could be a hung jury, and that's where they can't come to a unanimous decision, and there could be a single jury holdout. And that's kind of what they're saying Trump's lawyers are probably trying to do, is to get one person in there that's sympathetic enough to Trump that they would be willing to throw the whole case and side with him no matter what. Obviously, no juror is going to be allowed in that says that outright, but that's kind of what they're looking for in this jury selection. And if there is a hung jury and they can't come to a decision that's unanimous, it would end the trial without a verdict. It would require the prosecutors to bring a retrial, which would then definitely probably be pushed back to after the election, given Trump's skills at foot dragging when it comes to the law. He loves to do it, and he finds lawyers who are willing to do it for him. My prediction is a hung jury. This country is so divided. There are so many crazy Trump people out there that I am certain there was someone in that pool of people who is willing to kind of do whatever it takes to keep him from being convicted, even if there are people on the jury who believe, based on the evidence and the law, that he is guilty. I don't see it being possible to find 12 jurors and 6 alternates, and not one of those 18 people is a little bit loony for Trump, given just the statistics in this country. However, this is a Manhattan jury, and Manhattan is generally more liberal, democratic leaning, so who knows? But there are Trump supporters who have openly called for someone to get placed on that jury, who would then throw out the whole thing and be the one holdout juror. So it's very possible. And this is why jury selection is so important. It can make or break this case. And this country is so divided and so intensely partisan that getting this jury right is huge for the outcome of this case. Prosecutors are looking for people who were smart enough to apply the law to the facts, who are genuinely capable of being impartial, no matter what their opinion is on Trump or on politics. But like I said, Trump's lawyers are looking for someone who's going to be a holdout, who's a strong Trump supporter, but, you know, able to come across as sane enough to get onto this jury pool. So that's where we were at for this first week of the trial. Jury selection. And let's go day by day with the highlights of what you need to know happened this week. So Monday morning, Jury selection starts. Hundreds of jurors were called to report to the Lower Manhattan Court Monday morning, but jury selection didn't actually get underway until after 2 p.m. because the morning was spent with prosecutors and Trump's lawyers arguing over a few last-minute pieces of evidence and whether they would be entered before the jury. And this is really typical for lawyers to be kind of arguing about evidentiary issues up until the very last minute. And these issues can determine the scope of the trial, what the jurors are allowed to see and what they are not allowed to see. Specifically, first, the judge denied Trump's motion that the judge recuse himself because Trump says that the judge's daughter is involved in political consulting as a Democrat, and they claim that this was a conflict of interest. And the judge said, no, it's not. I'm staying. And that's good, because if the judge had agreed and said, yeah, I'll recuse myself, who knows how much longer this would be pushed back, which is, again, another Trump tactic. It's like, how long can we delay this thing? What can we file to get this thing as delayed as possible? But the judge said no. Then they were arguing over whether evidence of the other National Enquirer articles that were run about candidates running against Trump for the Republican nomination should be allowed in. Because, again, part of the prosecution's evidence is to show the catch-and-kill scheme of the National Enquirer. And by showing, hey, look at all these negative articles that they did publish, but there's none of Trump, it helps provide context for this underlying scheme. And the judge ruled that they will be allowed to introduce that into evidence. However, the judge, whose name is Judge Juan Marchan, he said he will not permit evidence relating to other accusations against Trump of harassing and abusing women. And the judge said that these were overly prejudicial. Though I do believe he will permit a reading into evidence of the transcript of the infamous grab 'em by the pussy Access Hollywood tape. They can't show the tape or play the tape, but they can read the transcript. So that will be allowed in. But the other allegations and accusations will not, because it's overly prejudicial. And that's an evidentiary rule where the judge has to weigh whether a piece of evidence its probative value outweighs its prejudicial value against the defendant. So is it overly prejudicial to the point where what it's proving isn't worth it to let it in? Like, it's going to make the jury dislike him so much that it's going to outweigh the need of the evidence. And in this case, the judge said, yeah, like, this is bad. It's overly prejudicial. It's not necessary for your case. At one point during these arguments, the highlight on Monday was Trump apparently fell asleep at one point. His head was kind of bobbing and then jerked up. And honestly, in his defense, court typically really fucking boring, especially when, like, the jury's not even there, the trial hasn't started, it's just lawyers arguing amongst themselves about legal technicalities. Holy fuck, is that boring. So, like, not to defend Trump, but in his defense, it's fucking boring. If you want to see, you can go sit in on hearings. Most of them are open to the public. So then, not until 2:30 on Monday did the jurors finally enter the courtroom. 96 potential jurors filed into the courtroom. They were sworn in, and then they were asked just generally whether they believed that they could remain impartial in this case. And literally half the room was like, nah, stood up and left. Half the room. So they were really easily able to kind of get rid of a large number of these potential jurors with that one question, hey, can you be impartial? A lot of people are like, nope, which made me wonder whether or not I could potentially be impartial. And I think the answer is no. Even though I am a lawyer and, like, you know, we're taught how to see both sides of an argument, and I like to think that I can generally do that, like, I think the anger's too deep. Anger's too deep. So then after that first wave of people left, they moved on to the jury questionnaire. This was a agreed upon 42 questions that the judge went down the line and asked each potential juror. So they pulled in 18 potential jurors into the jury box, and the judge went one by one down the row asking them each of the 42 questions. And these questions included typical juror questions like, what neighborhood do you live in? What do you do for work? What do you do for hobbies? But also what publications they read and social media platforms they use, what podcasts or radio shows they listen to. Have they ever read Trump's books? Have they ever been a member of the Proud Boys or QAnon? And then numerous of these 42 questions also kind of reiterated the need for impartiality and asked them in various different ways whether they have any beliefs about Trump or about politics or feelings of any sort that would interfere with their ability to be impartial. So even though these jurors were asked at the outset, can you remain impartial? And they said yes to that first question, they were then asked a few more times in a few different ways. And that did weed out more who I think were given more time to think about it in these different types of questions and like slowly realized, oh, actually, you know, when you say that, no, I don't think I could. So slowly jurors were dismissed one by one as they answered these questions. And then once that process of getting through the questionnaire was done, then the attorneys get a half hour to question the remaining jurors themselves. And this is called voir dire. Any juror can be struck for cause. So each lawyer will come and ask a number of questions, and then the lawyers will deliberate, and then they'll be able to present to the judge arguments for why certain jurors should be struck. Plus, each side gets 10 peremptory strikes, meaning that they can remove up to 10 jurors without cause. So they don't have to argue this is why they should be removed. They can just say, we're going to use a peremptory strike on this juror. We just don't want them. And some of that just comes down to like their gut feeling about a juror, but also attorneys will usually, especially in a case like this, will hire jury consultants, which are just people who have extensive experience picking juries. And so they will be able to deliberate with the jury consultants. The jury consultants will be able to, on the sidelines, be like searching the social media accounts of all of these potential jurors to weed them out. And that's kind of how they deliberate in real time as they're trying to select this jury. And so they were going through this process. And by the end of the day on Monday, day one, they had selected zero jurors. So it seemed as though this might take a while. Then Tuesday came back in the morning, and it began as Monday ended with more jury questioning and voir dire. Trump's team scrutinized the social media of the prospective jurors, as I said, and they asked the judge to strike a number of them because of anti-Trump posts they had found. And the judge agreed to remove two of the jurors, and then Trump's lawyers used their peremptory strikes to challenge the rest and to strike the rest of the people that they had found posted negatively about Trump on social media. But Tuesday was more successful for impaneling jurors. Four men and three women were selected that day to serve on the jury. So seven people were impaneled on Tuesday. A man originally from Ireland who works in sales was appointed the jury foreperson. So that's the person who serves as the panel spokesperson. Five of the seven had a college degree or higher education. Two men on the panel were lawyers. All but one of the jurors impaneled on Tuesday indicated that they were aware that Trump is facing charges in other criminal cases. So one person on that panel didn't know that he was facing charges in other criminal cases, which is wild. And none of them shared particularly strong views about Trump or politics, which is kind of what they were looking for, because having strong views will probably affect your impartiality. And the fact that two of these impaneled jurors are lawyers is actually really uncommon. Lawyers get called to jury duty like anyone else, but were rarely selected as jurors for a number of reasons. And some experts are saying that this could be good. Having two lawyers on this jury could be good for Trump's case if Trump's lawyers decide to argue some minute legal technicalities. It could throw enough doubt into the minds of these lawyers who are able to follow these legal technicalities and are trained to find flaws in legal arguments. It could throw enough doubt into their minds that they wouldn't be able to find beyond a reasonable doubt that Trump is guilty. So they'll be looking at details that maybe a typical juror wouldn't. Also, though, I have a really hard time believing that two attorneys don't have strong feelings one way or the other about Trump or about politics in general. Like, I feel like if you're particularly well educated in a field as politically adjacent as the law, that would probably mean that you know a lot about government, which would lead you to probably form opinions about government and therefore politics. And by its very nature, as a lawyer, you are working with laws and regulations, and you therefore likely have an opinion about how those laws and regulations should or shouldn't be written. I don't know. Seems fishy. Okay. But ultimately, the question isn't whether they believe strongly in Trump or not. The question is whether, despite whatever their views are, they believe they can remain impartial. And these attorneys said they could. And maybe attorneys are uniquely positioned to be able to do that because we're trained to see both sides, but I don't know. it's still very uncommon that there's two lawyers on this jury. So by the end of the day on Tuesday, day two, there were 7 jurors impaneled of a total of 12 plus 6 alternates that were needed. And each side had used 6 of their 10 peremptory strikes. So that's how we ended on Tuesday. Wednesday, there was no court, so court was not in session. So Thursday was day 3 of the trial. And on Thursday morning, one of the seated jurors, one that had already been chosen, was dismissed because she expressed fears that her identity was known and could lead to dangers for her safety. And while journalists have been instructed not to share information about the jurors, and the jury panel remains anonymous, some of the answers to the questionnaire were published by journalists, including some personally identifiable information about, you know, their workplaces, et cetera, which led this woman to fear that her identity would become known. So she was dismissed, which left 6 jurors, and the judge instructed journalists not to publish answers to the question about where people work and to try generally not to disclose personally identifying information about these jurors. And then later that day, another of the originally 7 impaneled jurors was excused, this time because prosecutors had found evidence that that juror had lied in his answers to the questionnaire and to the voir dire. They said they found evidence that he was convicted in the 90s of tearing down political posters. So yeah, lying while being impaneled as a jurist, not great. Don't do that. Try not to, at least. So then by the afternoon of Thursday, they were down to 5 impaneled jurors. They had lost 2. They were going backwards. So the process of jury questioning, first by the judge and then by the attorneys, repeated itself. And after a morning that made it seem like this jury selection process was going to take weeks, a surprisingly productive afternoon on Thursday led to the impaneling of all 12 jurors by the end of the day on Thursday. And those jurors include 7 men and 5 women. They work in a number of fields: sales, IT, teaching, the legal field, healthcare, and they represent a very wide diversity, which is typical of Manhattan, where the trial is taking place. And by diversity, I mean diversity of jobs and interests. Like, we don't know their races. But the overarching theme from a lot of them is that they don't really care about politics or pay much attention to the news or to politics, which I think there are arguments either way about whether that's good or bad, that's kind of how we select juries and the types of juries that we want. But I think there's a whole discussion to be had about juries generally. Anyway, so Thursday ended with all 12 jurors and 1 alternate selected. So by this morning, Friday morning, they just needed to find 5 more alternates. Friday morning, final step in the jury selection process, finished selecting the 6 alternate jurors who would be tapped in the event that a juror cannot serve, either because they become disqualified for talking about the case outside the courtroom, because their social media will be monitored, they're going to be monitored, or being exposed to news or something, or an illness or a conflict coming up. The alternates sit and hear all the testimony, just like the regular jurors, but they don't participate in the deliberations unless they're called to do so after a juror is dismissed. And analysts are saying that it's highly likely that alternates will be needed during this trial. Something's gonna come up that's gonna disqualify these jurors. Not all of them, but a couple. Before court began on Friday, Trump made a statement, like he's been doing all week, outside the courthouse, complaining about the gag order against him, saying that it had to be lifted because he wants to be able to disparage witnesses and the judge the way that our founding fathers meant for the First Amendment to be exercised. It's his right as American. Anyway, Friday, the same process continues, bringing in jurors, the judge going through the questionnaire, and then the attorneys questioning the remaining potential jurors, and it continued throughout the morning as they were trying to find more alternates. And a number of potential jurors were dismissed after expressing fear and anxiety, specifically over their potential participation in the trial. One woman broke down crying because of her anxiety, which, like, fair girl. The process continued, but by 2 p.m., all 6 alternates had been chosen and jury selection came to a close. However, minutes after jury selection was finished and the newly impaneled jury was sworn in, a man doused himself in gasoline and lit himself on fire in the park across the street from the courthouse and was shortly carried away on a stretcher. And prior to lighting himself on fire, he threw a bunch of flyers around the park that said, "NYU is a mob front," and had various allegations of wrongdoing against the school. So it's unclear what his motivation was in this. And then at 3:15 Friday afternoon, a hearing was held after jury selection finished. so that the judge could hear arguments and decide whether prosecutors could bring up Trump's prior legal issues if he does choose to take the stand in his own defense. So that gave Judge Marchand the ability to make a decision on this. So this separate hearing is called a Sandoval hearing. It's a routine process for the court to determine to what extent Trump's past wrongdoing can be brought in the current trial. And that hearing is literally underway as I'm filming this right now. So I'm going to just insert here what the judge ultimately decided. So as I said, Trump made numerous statements throughout the week as he entered and left the courtroom and took breaks. Like he'd kind of walk up to the little gate and just start talking. Sometimes he had things in his hands. Clearly he was using it as a publicity stunt, which I guess is good multitasking because he's supposed to be out campaigning right now. Like he's supposed to be running for president, but instead he's sitting in this courtroom, which is, you know, this dingy courtroom in southern Manhattan that's apparently very cold. That's been the overarching theme. Trump's complaining about it. The jurors are complaining about it. It's cold. But the judge said, yeah, it's cold, but if we turn it up a couple degrees, then it's going to get really hot and I'd rather be cold than sweating, which is fair because those judges' robes look sweaty. And after jury selection concluded today, Trump immediately took to Truth Social, complaining that the judge is railroading him and once again calling for an end to the gag order against him. So looking ahead, what to expect in week two of this trial? Opening arguments are scheduled to begin Monday morning, April 22nd at 9:30 a.m. Eastern time. Opening arguments give both sides the opportunity to explain their cases to the jury. After opening arguments, then the prosecution will call its first witness and begin laying out the details of its case. But oral arguments are also the first time that the public gets to hear a clear idea of each side's case and strategy. You can sometimes get a general idea of each side's case, as the trial gets closer based on arguments, lists of witnesses, list of evidence, etc. But neither side is required to disclose their actual arguments until the trial begins. So opening arguments are a great way to get a summation of what the arguments will be throughout the trial. And then from there, the trial is expected to last 6 to 8 weeks. So I will be here every week laying out what you need to know about what happened that week. For more analysis and behind the scenes content and information, check out my Patreon linked in the description, and I will be back next Friday for another special installment as this Trump trial continues. Thanks so much for watching. Have a good day. Bye-bye.